And on the way, we're talking to a space expert all about if there really are aliens out there, whether we'll ever meet extraterrestrial life, and actually, if maybe the aliens are already down here on Earth, but we just can't see them. You can find out loads more about that. He's on the way a little later. We'll also talk about one of the most dangerous beasts in the water of Africa. And you can hear why giant slugs are terrorising Russia. It's on the way. First, let's catch up with Techno Mum, our gadget genius, talking all about how smart technology is making life easier.
Techno Mum's Connected World.
I was getting ready for school and telling Mum about the new amazing interactive studio that we have. It can project movies onto all the walls and the floor. And the ceiling too, to make it seem like you're really in ancient Rome, or the moon, or even 1,000 meters under the sea. It's so cool. I can't wait for my form to get our turn.
And to think that I had to make do with a chalkboard. Like lots of modern buildings, your school is really using technology in a lot of new and exciting ways.
Yeah, like the lights. They only go on if someone's in the room. That helps save energy. It's the same with the heating too.
That's certainly smart. And technology is going to get even smarter. Think about how your school already connects technology together at lunchtime.
You mean how I pay for my school dinners with my fingerprint?
You see, that's an example of a connected building. I upload your dinner money to a payment website, and the sensors in the school cafe upload the amount you've spent each day to work out the new balance.
Does that mean you can go online and see exactly how much I spent?
Sure can.
And can you tell, what I spent it on?
You mean I can tell if you chose 10 sticky buns instead of a sandwich? The technology could do that for sure, but don't worry, your school doesn't include that information. Not yet.
I don't like the sound of that. I demand lunch privacy!
Well, that's why it's important to be careful what digital information we share and with whom. Often there's the opportunity to decide for ourselves. If you're a 9, you may get something called privacy policy to check out.
But they're always really, really long and boring.
Well, get me or Dad to have a look. We filled out paper forms about your lunch options to agree to using the fingerprint technology in a way that was right for our family.
I suppose the school could take the information about what we had ordered and use the internet to instantly place new orders of the popular foods so they'd never run out of sticky buns.
Absolutely. And think about the lifts. Sometimes they break down, and that can mean kids running late to class.
And that's really a problem for the kids and teachers who use wheelchairs.
What if the lift could diagnose itself, upload the data to the internet, and find out how to fix its computer programs? And all in a matter of seconds, perhaps?
Almost like the building's alive. You'd never have to take the register. You could use smartphones to track where all us kids are, and ring them up or message them if they were in the wrong place.
That would have been handy when you started at that school.
Sure would. I was wandering around science block for an hour when I should have been in PE.
Well, we all have to learn. And buildings, smart connected buildings, can learn too. Like, is it too hot or cold in a classroom?
If any of the equipment is on the blink.
And which corridors are the busiest? All this information shared between devices, computers, the internet, to help make buildings smarter and more comfortable places to be.
School? Comfortable?
Well, not as comfortable as lounging around in your pyjamas. Come on, you. Time to get dressed.
Techno Mum's Connected World, with support from the Institution of Engineering and Technology. Find out more at pungidslive.com/technomum.
I got a few of your questions to answer right now. Thank you so much for sending them in, by the way, over as a review on Apple Podcasts. If you've got something sciencey sorted, that's what you need to do. Let me know what it is there, and I will do all the research for you. Let me see. This is from Dylan in the UK. Hey, Dylan, who asks, what's the furthest a robot has ever travelled? Well, that'll be Voyager 1, Dylan, a space probe that was launched on September the 5th back in 1977, which means it's been up floating around in space for over 41 years. And right now, it's over 13.6 billion miles away. It's flown by Jupiter, by Saturn, by Uranus, by Pluto. It's taken photos of all of them. In 1990, it took the first photo of the solar system as seen from the outside of it. And since then, it's just got further and further into space. And the plan is for it to just carry on. And scientists think that in 300,000 years, it will pass within less than one light year of the M3V star TYC 3135-52-1. So big deal. Thank you so much for the question, Dylan. Let's move on now to Alexa from East. I'm sorry if your Alexa went off when I said that. Alexa, by the way. I didn't mean to say Alexa so much. I make your Alexa go off. Anyway, this is from Alexa in East London in the UK as well, who asks, why do humans go to the loo every day, but sloths only need to go to the toilet once or twice a week? Well, we poop to get rid of undigested food and bacteria, things that we eat that don't need to get used in our body. They have to be expelled, and we go really as often as we like because it's safe normally for us to do so. And that's the point. Sloths, they need to pick their moments. You see, they live in trees, but they go to the loo down on the ground, which is different from monkeys and some other tree climbers who just kind of poo wherever. They just let it drop out. But sloths, they need to make the slow descent to go to the loo on the ground. And it often puts them at risk of predators. So they want to cut down how often they have to go down there. In fact, get this, more than half of sloth deaths happen during toilet time when they have to go down to the ground. And lastly, this is from Sean Mashup. Hey, Sean, who asks why the core of the Earth is so hot and how hot really is it? Well, the core of the Earth is a solid ball of iron and nickel, and the pressure of all the rock above it pushes it together really tightly. And there are three main reasons mainly why it's hot. It's because heat from when the planet was first formed is still there. It can't get free. Also, frictional heating as the core itself moves around, that warms everything up. And it's also hot because the radioactive elements inside it are decaying. And the most recent estimation of how hot the Earth's core is 6,000 degrees Celsius, which is as hot as the surface of the sun. Blows your mind, doesn't it? Right down there, beneath our feet, right now, something burning and bubbling away. Thank you so much for that, Sean. If you've got a question you want answered in the show, you need to leave it as a review over on Apple Podcasts. It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Now, did you see in the news the other day there was a plan to try and storm Area 51? Not really the best idea because I think it's like a military base and they'll have armed army manning it at all times. But people wanted to see if the rumours were true and there were aliens inside. So it got me thinking, are there aliens inside? Are there aliens anywhere? And moreover, why haven't we seen any aliens yet? So fantastic news. We've got in the studio the author Stephen Ricard, who can possibly help us answer because he's written a book. It's called Why Haven't We Seen Aliens? Hey, Stephen.
Hi there.
Thank you so much for joining us. Now, first and foremost, let's deal with the big question, the name of the book. Answer it for me. Why haven't we seen aliens yet?
Well, it's a kind of trick question because I do answer it in the book, or I try and answer it. But actually, the book is an excuse to write about lots of other really interesting ideas and things that hang together under that idea of why we haven't seen aliens.
So talk me through some of the ideas then that this book does talk us through.
Well, at the beginning, I kind of say, well, there's three possible answers to the question. One is that there aren't any aliens, so that's why we haven't seen them, which is perfectly possible. Another answer is that we have seen them and they're already here. So if you kind of see the odd, weird person walking around, maybe that's one of those aliens. Although maybe, if we think about it, the aliens are a bit cleverer than that, so the really normal people are the ones that are actually the aliens. And the kind of not so normal looking people are just like you and me. And then there's the kind of third answer, which is the proper answer, which is, well, we really need to look at the science and look at the universe that we live in and do our best to try and get an answer to that question.
So let's try and expand on the third one then. It always baffles me when we hear people usually on the telly talking about aliens, and they always give the theory life as we know it. That's the words that they always use, life as we know it. Now, surely, if there are aliens out there, it's not going to be life as we know it. Talk to me about those words, if you can, Stephen. What is life as we know it when we are searching for aliens?
Well, life as we know it, the only life that we know is the life that we know on Earth, which is everything from bacteria to pet dogs and cats to ourselves, you know, the whole range of living things. So it's kind of hard to work out what aliens, if they exist, would actually look like. And one of the things I do look at in the book is what would aliens look like if we did actually meet them? And you can't say, well, they're all going to be grey or they're all going to be green, but you can sort of have a stab at some answers, because we can look at what's happened to life on Earth and we can sort of say, well, what happened on Earth? Maybe the same kinds of things, because the same scientific processes are going on around the universe, because we think science is a universal thing, you know, rules of science or laws of science are pretty universal. So, for example, we have got lots of cars on our planet and they've all got wheels. Most of them have got four wheels. But we haven't really come across any life that I'm aware of on Earth that uses wheels to get around. We use legs or we slither or fins, all kinds of solutions to the business of getting around, but none of them involve wheels. So why is that? Well, I'm guessing that wheels have got axles and the wheely bit has to go around the axle-y bit and you get friction and stuff gets worn away. And that's okay if you replace your car every 5 years, but if you've got to live for 70 years with bits rubbing away, it kind of gets a bit difficult. And also wheels are not very good for going up steps and, you know, all the rest of it. So one of the things I suggest in the book is that maybe the kinds of ways that aliens would get around would be very similar to the kinds of ways that life gets around on Earth.
Without wheels?
I'm guessing probably without wheels. And yes, unless they found a solution to that little problem.
If we're talking about, life as we know it, what do the fundamental building blocks of life need to exist? If we were to find another planet that could facilitate life, what would it need?
Gosh, we don't even know the answer to that. We think, and when I say we, I'm talking about the scientific community now.
You can talk for them on this show, that's okay.
Okay, thank you. I'll do my best. Carbon, we think that all life on Earth is carbon-based. And we suspect that all life in the universe is also based on carbon. But there are some scientists who think that silicon, which is another element, would be a very good basis for the chemistry of life being formed from that.
What do you mean when you talk about that? So why is life all carbon-based at the moment? Is it just that's what we had a lot of during the Big Bang?
It's where we came from. We started with amino acids and the whole process of building life. I mean, that's another thing we don't know, is how life started, where life started. When I was young, we were all told that life had to start. We looked at solar systems. We looked at the idea of planets orbiting a star. And we said, well, there has to be a habitable zone. There has to be this bit which is not too far away from the star where it's going to be quite warm, but it's not so near that it's going to be really hot. And water is one thing that we need for life, so we think. So we said any life on one of these solar systems, in one of these solar systems, has got to be on a planet which is not too distant and not too far from the star. So people called it the Goldilocks zone because it, you know, the porridge thing. So that's what everybody thought until quite recently, probably in the last 10 years. And we've discovered deep, deep, deep under the sea, in miles under the sea, this life that's being formed and thriving in what we call hydrothermal vents. And it's nothing like the kind of life that we know about up here, because oxygen would kill the life down there. But it's thriving and it's having a great time. And then we look at a moon orbiting Saturn called Enceladus. And there's a couple of moons out there orbiting Saturn and Jupiter. And they're both huge planets, so they've got huge gravity. So these moons are getting, as they orbit the planet, they're getting pulled and pulled by gravity, pulled and squashed by it, like a little rubber ball, and they're heating up. And we're suddenly finding there's all these volcanic vents and all this kind of stuff going on. Really hot moons, thousands and thousands of miles from the sun. And they're, you know, historically we said, well, life can't exist there because it's too cold. And now we're having to reinvent all our theories because it's hot. And I think NASA are now sending something out there to have a look.
Just stepping away from science slightly to talk about history, I'm not sure if you can answer this, but I'll give it a go. How much of the idea of aliens are a fantasy in recent times? I mean, if you were to travel back a few hundred years, was anyone worried about extraterrestrial life back then?
What a good question. No, I don't think so. Again, one of the things I talk about in the book is not just the science, but actually our human understanding of the universe and how that's changed over time. So back in the times of the ancient Greeks, planet is actually a word that means wanderer in Greek, because the planets were these little glowing things that used to move about. But the rest of the sky, when they looked at it at night, didn't really move, and they just thought it was a sheet of something that was the kind of outer circle, and these planets moved about in circles inside that. And it was only really in the early 1920s, when this guy called Edwin Hubble, who was actually a lawyer and a part-time astronomer, actually discovered that, A, there was this thing called the universe that was much more than what we thought at the time, but actually, God damn it, he realised it was expanding. And that was absolutely terrifying. It completely changed.
And after Hubble made that discovery, at what point in the last 90 years did we start thinking, you know what, there may be other things out there and maybe they want to say hello?
Well, there's been a few people who've been thinking it for quite a long time, and they used to be regarded as extremely odd people and were largely ignored. And I think slowly the scientific community gradually moved to the possibility, because when we realised that, you know, we're part of the Milky Way galaxy, but we realised there are hundreds and thousands, possibly millions, billions of galaxies, we're not on our own. And there's a lot of stars. There's a lot of planets orbiting those stars. We've actually found 4,000 of them, I think, in the last 5 years or so. So a lot of what we thought was possible or a bit weird, we're actually now finding out is actually real. And that really gets you thinking about the possibility of their life being out there.
You just mentioned NASA making moves to go and check out these extraterrestrial volcanoes. Are we doing anything else to maybe get in contact with aliens that might be up there?
Yes, we are. There's a guy called Frank Drake, who is very old now, and he has been pushing very, very hard for most of his life for us to be looking out there and trying to find alien life. And he was one of the people that was involved in SETI, S-E-T-I, which is the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And they've been doing a lot of different things. And some people in SETI have been quite disappointed that we haven't really received any messages from aliens. But when you do the numbers and you look at the time that we've been around and the size of the universe, I think it's really not that surprising. But that's the big giveaway, because that's kind of the end of the... That's the conclusion I reach in the book.
Well, it's because it's all about time, isn't it? It's all about time and the fact that, we've only been here. There's that that statistic where if the world, the life of the world were a 20, or the life of the universe were a whole day, we've been here for pretty much a minute of it, or even less than
absolutely.
That. You've got the answers to all that and loads more in the brand new book, Haven't We Seen Aliens? It's by Stephen Ricard. Thank you so much, Stephen, for coming in the studio.
Pleasure. Glad to be here.
This week's Dangerous Dan sees us head to Africa to have a look at its largest crocodile. The Nile crocodile is a fearsome, toothy beast. It can grow to 20 feet long. Let me put that in perspective. That is as long as a giraffe is tall. and they can weigh almost a ton. They live in the Nile Basin, throughout the rivers, marshes and swamps around Africa as well. Now, they're quite protective parents, which makes them quite aggressive. You see, many crocs, when they lay eggs, they'll kind of leave them to hatch on their own, do their own thing. But the Nile crocodile will stay there, waiting for them, keeping watch. Now, crocodiles as a species tend to have the strongest bite of any animal, and the Niles are right at the top of that. They can take down anything, including hippos. And they're a ridiculously aggressive creature. And check this out. According to CrocBite, which is a worldwide crocodile attack database, it published these facts back in 2016. American alligators and crocodiles have killed 33 people since the turn of the century, the year 2000. But the Nile crocodile, a different species, has killed 268 people in that time. Loads more than any other crocodile species. That's why the Nile crocodile has to go on our Dangerous Dan list. It's time to catch up with Safety Seymour right now. He's our superhero that's looking into gas and the gases that you can't smell, you can't detect really at all, but they're incredibly dangerous.
Safety Seymour, CO Hero.
Safety Seymour at your service. I'm on a mission to recruit CO safety assistants to help on my quest to rid homes of a very dangerous threat. The threat of CO. That's carbon monoxide.
So if I want to become a CO safety assistant, where do I start?
Well, you need to know your enemy.
But carbon monoxide is an invisible gas. I haven't got X-ray vision.
To see how carbon monoxide is created, we'll have to shrink down to the size of an atom. Are you ready?
Like Ant-Man. Awesome, let's do it. Wow. Are we inside a central heating boiler?
We are indeed. The heat is making the carbon atoms from the fuel combine with oxygen in the air. This process, called combustion, happens in all sorts of appliances like boilers, cookers, and even the barbecue.
Whoa! Each carbon atom now has one, two oxygen atoms attached to it.
That's right! And has created carbon dioxide. It's the gas you find in fizzy drinks. It's not normally dangerous in small quantities, but come this way. Look over there! There's not enough oxygen to go around, and so each carbon atom from the fuel is joining with just one oxygen atom.
And is that how carbon monoxide is made?
Correct! Different molecules have different properties. Carbon monoxide is very poisonous to humans, even in small amounts, because it steals the oxygen in our bloodstream. This can make us very sick. Or even worse.
Sounds like we need to make sure it doesn't get into our houses. Or if it is there, that it can escape outside.
That's right. It's important that boilers, cookers, heaters, anything with a burning flame are checked regularly to make sure they're working correctly.
What about out here in the garden? Should we be checking the barbecue, fire baskets or bonfires?
They are not harmful if they are outside, but you should never take barbecues into small or confined spaces like tents. And you should never have fires inside, unless you have a way for the nasty gas to escape, like up through a swept chimney.
Why is carbon monoxide not dangerous when it's outside?
Because it mixes with the oxygen and other gases outside. It loses its strength.
Good to know. But inside...
We can use a very clever gadget.
A carbon monoxide alarm.
Bingo! Now you're getting it!
Cool.
A carbon monoxide alarm is a bit like a smoke alarm, but instead of detecting smoke, it detects...
carbon monoxide!
Indeed! And every house should have one.
So how does it work?
You put it in your home, switch it on, and then if carbon monoxide is detected, it gives you a warning. If you ever hear the alarm, tell an adult and leave the house until it has been checked by a gas-safe registered engineer. Keep yourself safe and your family out of harm. Get yourself a carbon monoxide alarm. Right, got to go. In case I'm not around to help, it's a good idea to ask your parents to get a carbon monoxide alarm. then you too can be a CO safety assistant.
Thanks, Seymour. Laters.
Safety Seymour, CO Hero, with support from Cadent and Northern Gas Networks. Find out more at funkidslive.com/Seymour.
Let's get all the science that has been in your news this week. The top 10 warmest years on record have all happened in the last 17 years, new analysis from the Met Office has shown. You see, last week they confirmed that the UK recorded its hottest temperature ever of 38.7 degrees Celsius over 100 degrees Fahrenheit, and the Met Office are trying to use all this data to figure out what hot years mean for our climate crisis. Also, Ethiopia has planted more than 350 million trees in a single day, which they believe is a world record. It aims to counter the effects of deforestation. 100 years ago, 35% of the country was covered in forests, and now only 4% of it is. And they want to plant 4 billion trees before they're done. And finally, giant orange slugs are causing alarm in Russia. The Arion vulgaris slugs. They are six inches long. They're huge compared to other slugs, and they're pests. They can absolutely ravage vegetable plots. They first cropped up in Spain a couple of years ago. I think we spoke about it on the show, actually. And now they have headed across Europe to take over Moscow. And that is it for the Fun Kids Science Weekly this week, sponsored by Drayton Manor. Thank you so much for having a listen to the show. Remember, if you've got a science question that you really want answered, something that you've thought about over the summer, maybe you've been boiled alive by the sun, and you want to figure out why it's so strong, considering we're all this way away from it, ask me. I will do all the research for you. Doesn't matter what it's about, as long as it's sciencey. Head over to Apple Podcasts and leave the show a review. Make sure you stick 5 stars as well. That helps us out. And leave your name as well, so I know who to say hello to. While you're on Apple Podcasts, it's one of the best places for you to hear all our brilliant science series. You've heard some today. We've got loads more. They're also on Google, on Spotify as well. You can find it on the free Fun Kids app and at funkidslive.com. And Fun Kids, we're a children's radio station from the UK. You can find us on your DAB digital radio across the country on that free app. And as always, at funkidslive.com. I will see you next week. Goodbye.